theme of the prophet's vision has to do with the Babylonian captivity and the deliverance from the Babylonian captivity. And what he focuses on here at the beginning of chapter 46 is the fact that the destruction of Babylon is a judgment upon Babylon's gods. You remember that when the Jews were held captive in Egypt, and God sent the plagues in the time of Moses to deliver the people from Pharaoh, that God said that through these plagues he would judge all the gods of Egypt. And in fact, the plagues of Egypt, many of them directly affected various gods of Egypt. When the sun was turned to darkness, it was a direct insult to the Egyptian sun god Ra. They also had a frog god, and God brought frogs upon the land in such numbers that the people probably never wanted to see another frog, which would have disenchanted them with their frog god. And there were, of course, the Nile River was a god to the Egyptians also, and he turned it into blood, which was an abomination to them. And many times the plagues that God brought on Egypt to bring the deliverance of Israel out served a double purpose, not only of convincing the Egyptians to let him go, but also in bringing a divine judgment upon the gods of Egypt. And here we see that there is a spiritual warfare that God is engaged in, even in the Old Testament, himself versus the other gods. Now, we realize, of course, that the other gods are not real beings at all, that the gods of the heathen are simply carved statues and don't have any real existence as gods. Yet the Bible teaches that behind these idols were demonic powers. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10:20 that the sacrifices that the heathen offer, they offer to demons and not to gods. So even though the idols were not alive and the gods' names were not referring to real gods, of course, yet there was a demonic influence behind these idols, so that the heathen were worshiping demonic powers. And even when Paul came to Athens in Acts chapter 17, and he saw the idols around. Remember, he was vexed in his spirit because he saw so many idols, and he found the shrine to the unknown God. And when he spoke to the Athenians on Mars Hill, he said, "I see that in all things you are very superstitious, and I saw an altar to the unknown God, and I've come to tell you about him." The word superstitious there in the Greek actually means fearing demons. Paul said to the Athenians, "I see that you fear demons." And they didn't take that as an insult. Actually, the word fear is more in the sense of worshiping demons. You know, like they feared Jehovah. The Jews feared Jehovah. The Athenians feared demons. They worshipped these demonic powers. And that was no insult to them, because to the heathen, demons were not a bad thing necessarily. They were just the powers behind their gods. And so, in bringing a destruction upon the gods of the heathen, God got no great satisfaction just destroying wooden and metal idols, although he was glad to see them go. There was a greater destruction taking place, and that was on the power of the demonic religions that held the people when God brought his judgment upon them. The destruction of Babylon is here characterized in the first two verses of chapter 46.
Sing anymore. He hung up his...
Save that for next time.
So the leading characters in Babylon that we know from the Bible, for instance, Nebuchadnezzar has the name Nebu in it, or Nebo. Belshazzar has the name Bel in it. Nebuchadnezzar, the father of Belshazzar, has the name Nebo in his name. And the kings of Babylon would sometimes have the names of their god incorporated into their own royal names. And so Bel and Nebo are very principal gods of Babylon. And it says in the opening verses, Bel boweth down, Nebo stoopeth. Their idols were upon the beasts and upon the cattle. Your carriages were heavy loaden. They are a burden to the weary beast. They stoop, they bow down together. They could not deliver the burden, but themselves are gone into captivity. Then in contrast, he says, Hearken unto me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, which are born by me from the belly, which are carried from the womb. And even to your old age I am he, and even to hoar hairs, which means to the time you have white hair, hoar means white, I will carry you. I have made and I will bear, even I will carry and will deliver you. Now, there's supposed to be an obvious contrast here, which you might have caught. In verses 3 and 4, God emphasizes how he carries and bears his people. He carried them from the womb, and he'll carry them until their old age. And he emphasizes again and again, I will bear you, I will carry you. And so the Babylonian gods are set in contrast to him in that they can't carry their people. In fact, they have to be carried on ox carts. He sees the idols being brought down and being carried away in carts. It says your carriages were heavy laden or loaded in verse 1. They are a burden to the weary beast. The beasts are carrying away the gods of Babylon. Far from being able to carry their people, the gods of Babylon have to be carried themselves. Now, heathen idols were sometimes carried about by their priests in ceremonious processions in heathen lands. And these idols, no doubt, would have on occasions been carried about in celebrations of the Babylonians, celebrating their victories and so forth, in processions that they had in parades. But now, the idols, whether they have ever been gloriously carried about in the streets, regardless of whether that has ever been the case, now they have the indignity of being carted off in ox carts behind weary animals. And so the idea here is in verse 2, they couldn't deliver the burden. They themselves are gone into captivity. As they were unable to deliver and carry the burden of their people. The idols themselves have gone into captivity. And this is God's judgment that comes upon the Babylonian idols. And therefore, the setting for this section of Isaiah has to do with the fall of Babylon. When you get to chapter 47, you'll find that it, in its entirety, the whole chapter 47, is a lament or a taunt song against Babylon and about its fall, somewhat similar to that we find in Isaiah chapter 14. So we're talking about the fall of Babylon here, and it starts out with a statement about how their gods are fallen. They've stooped down. They're being carried away. So he says to Israel that they should hearken to him in verse 3, and notice he speaks of the house of Jacob and all the remnant of the house of Israel. Basically, these terms are used in parallel to each other. So the reference to the house of Jacob or the house of Israel refers to the remnant. And that should be something we would remember as we read of the promises to the house of Israel throughout the book of Isaiah, that he uses the term house of Israel in parallel with the expression the remnant. And therefore he speaks really of the remnant when he speaks of Israel. He says that they are born from him, born by God from the belly, and they are carried from the womb. Now that simply means that God has carried this nation from their inception. He's not talking exactly about his personal care for each individual Jew from the womb, although the statement would apply there too, but that doesn't seem to be his meaning. Rather, he's talking to the house of Israel as a whole, saying that they, as a people, have been cared for by God from their very beginning and unto their old age. He will continue to carry them. I think verse 4 is a good verse to memorize for those who fear old age, and I think that's almost everyone except people who have learned to trust God. Because old age is one of the great things that our society, and I suppose every society in the past, has somehow feared, because when your body starts to give out and your hair gets white and your skin gets wrinkled, that's just bearing testimony to the fact that death is approaching, that you're past your prime. The days of productivity are largely in your past, and you now look forward to the end of your life. And that scares a lot of people. And one of the things that scares a lot of people about aging is that whereas when they were young and strong and in their prime, they had the energy and the strength and the wits and the opportunities to go out and support themselves and take care of themselves. But when they get old and infirm and their organs start to malfunction and so forth, they may not be able to support themselves. And therefore, of course, retirement programs and everything are considered to be a very important thing. And if you listen to the radio, secular radio, very much, you'll notice that a lot of banks and lending institutions and savings and loans are advertising IRAs and things, and they'll say, you know, in days like these, you've got to be secure about your old age, and you need to put away some money and everything. And in spite of the fact that Jesus said the opposite, where he said, take no thought for the morrow, what you shall eat or what you shall drink, sufficient to the day is the trouble thereof. Jesus indicated that if God takes care of you today, if he took care of you yesterday, you have every good reason to believe he'll take care of you tomorrow. And a verse like this one, Isaiah 46:4, is something that should alleviate any concern about aging. I myself have obviously not put anything away for my old age, and I won't even if I have the opportunity. If I would inherit a fortune, I would not put away anything for my old age, because I believe that when God gives us finances and opportunities and strength now. He doesn't want us to do that to lay up something for our old age. He does it so that we can put those things into use into his kingdom now. He'll take care of us when we're old, just like he takes care of us now. If we ever doubt that, then it shows that we are really trusting our own strength now more than we're perhaps willing to acknowledge. If we say, well, I know he's taking care of me now, but I'm not sure he'll take care of me when I'm old and infirm, what you're saying is, I believe he can take care of me as long as I'm strong enough to take care of myself. But as soon as I'm unable to take care of myself, I'm not sure God will take care of me. Which obviously means that the common denominator is your strength, is when you feel strong, is when you feel secure. When you feel weak, you feel insecure. And therefore, God is not really the one that's being trusted. But a verse like this should be memorized, I think, whenever the devil brings up suggestions to you, if you're thinking about serving God or on the mission field or living a forsake all kind of life and you're not putting away money for your old age or anything like that, you know, just remember this verse. God said, I carried you this far, I'll carry you when you're old too. He says, even to your old age I am he, even to your hoar hairs will I carry you. That is, till even when you have white hair, I have made and I will bear, even I will carry and will deliver you. To whom will ye liken me, and make me equal, and compare me, that we may be like? They lavish gold out of the bag, and weigh silver in the balance, and hire a goldsmith, and he maketh it a god. They fall down, yea, they worship, they bear him upon their shoulder, again emphasizing that the heathen gods have to be carried by their worshippers, in contrast to God carrying his worshippers, carrying his people. They bear this god upon their shoulder, they carry him, and set him in his place, and he standeth. From his place shall he not be removed, or shall he not remove. Yea, one shall cry unto him, yet can he not answer, nor save him out of his trouble. Remember this, and show yourselves men. Bring it again to mind, O ye transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God, and there is none else. I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Calling a ravenous bird from the east, this is a reference to Cyrus, a man that executeth my counsel from a far country, yea, I have spoken it, I will also bring it to pass, I have purposed it, I will also do it. Hearken unto me, ye stout-hearted, that are far from righteousness, I bring near my righteousness, it shall not be far off, and my salvation shall not tarry, and I will place salvation in Zion for Israel my glory. Now, here in verses 5 through 11, particularly, God says something very similar to what he's been saying repeatedly in this section. That is, compare him, if you please, with the other gods. The other gods are fashioned by men's hands and are totally helpless. They have to be carried if they're to be moved. People call to them, but the gods can't answer because they have no intelligence. They have no mouth. They can't speak. They're dead. And therefore, he says, remember that, verse 8. In other words, remember, Israel, that I am a God who has carried you. I am a God who has shown myself strong on your behalf. These idols can do nothing for you. Well, he says in verse 9, remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is none else. I am God, there is none like me. What he's saying is, remember your history. Remember how God has delivered you in the past. But besides that, he's saying, remember that I said that a true God, like myself, can predict the future, whereas false gods cannot. And he says, I am the one who has predicted the future accurately. Therefore, I'm unlike other gods. Verse 10, declaring the end from the beginning. That is to say, God can tell you anything you want to know, regardless of what point in time it refers to, even future. From the end to the beginning, he can declare it all. From the ancient times, he spoke the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Now, what he's saying is that he's not only presently speaking, but from ancient times he has spoken about things that even now haven't yet been fulfilled. That is to say, the time gap between the prediction and the fulfillment is so great that at the moment in time where we stand, we could speak of the time of prediction as ancient times. It was a long time ago. And yet, from where we stand, we still look forward to the fulfillment, emphasizing the fact that God can see things at a great distance. Now, God's foreknowledge is something that he declares repeatedly in this part of Isaiah, though he nowhere tells us how he knows the future. And we don't know how he knows the future. As I think I've pointed out before, it is a popular theory, though not necessarily found in the scripture, that God lives outside of the realm of time, and that he does not experience time in a moment-by-moment basis like we do, but that time is a created reality, and God dwells outside of and above all of his creation. Therefore, he dwells in what some would say is eternity, and eternity encompasses all of time, even that part which is yet future to us. Yet it's not future to God, because God lives, as some put it, in the eternal now. Now, this is not something the Bible declares to be true. This is just a philosophical attempt to explain how God does know the future. It suggests that those things that we call future are already present with him. In fact, everything is present with him all at once. And that may be true. The Bible doesn't say if it's true or if it isn't true. This verse would give us the impression that the reason God knows the future is because he has the power to make things come to pass that he declares. He says, from ancient times, I declare the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel will stand, I will do all my pleasure. And then he gives the example of calling Cyrus. In other words, the suggestion here seems to be that he knows what Cyrus will do. Maybe not so much just that he can see it, but that he's going to make it happen. He will do what he wants to do. His counsel will be fulfilled because he is sovereign. And so some would understand God's foreknowledge in this light, that it's not that God can see the future so much as that he is powerful enough to make things happen that he has predicted. And he knows what's going to happen because he knows that he can make them happen. Now, again, we don't know if that's the only sense in which he knows the future, and that might be a limiting of him too. But we don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us how he knows. But it's interesting here, he links his foreknowledge with his sovereignty, that he will do whatever he wants to do. He will do all his pleasure. And if he wants to call a ravenous bird from the east, meaning Cyrus, then it'll happen. And at the end of verse 11, he says, I have spoken it, I also will bring it to pass, I have purposed it, I also will do it. So the suggestion here, now this certainly doesn't give us a full treatment of the subject of God's foreknowledge, but this at least focuses on the fact that God could know the future simply because he has the power to make things happen. You know, fortune tellers and psychics who use demonic powers rather than God's power sometimes make some accurate predictions. Gene Dixon and Edgar Casey and some of the more celebrated psychics of our time, you know, their followers will try to point out that they made several predictions that came true. And that is perhaps the case. We wouldn't deny that on some occasions Satan may be able to make an accurate prediction. After all, probably some persons acting without Satan's help could probably make accurate predictions. I mean, there's always a chance that what you predict will take place. And Satan has a certain amount of ability to manipulate circumstances, so it is possible for Satan, for instance, to tell a psychic that such and such a thing is going to happen. And then Satan seeks to use what powers he has to make it happen. And if he succeeds, then people will say, ah, you see, the psychic saw the future. Where in fact, what has happened is Satan told the psychic what he, that is Satan, intended to bring to pass. And if he's successful, it appears as though he knew the future. But the fact of the matter is Satan is not omnipotent. Satan is not sovereign. And therefore many things that Satan intends to do never get done because God doesn't permit him to. God puts up roadblocks, and therefore we find that every psychic who makes predictions has at least as many predictions that don't come true as ones that do. And I'd say if the truth were known, the vast majority of their predictions don't ever come true. If a few do, they get a lot of front page publicity on the scandal sheets at the supermarkets. But the hundreds of predictions that never came true by them are ignored for the most part. But you might say, well, how did they know that John F. Kennedy would be assassinated in Dallas before it ever happened? Well, I have no doubt that it was the purpose of Satan to see him assassinated, and no doubt he told Gene Dixon all about it, and on this occasion God didn't stop him because it happened to be somehow amenable with the purposes of God. Not that God had a thing out for John F. Kennedy, but simply God didn't stop it from happening and must have therefore had some purpose in it. But the many other predictions that Gene Dixon makes that don't happen simply represent cases where no doubt her spirit guide, her demon, made predictions which the demon thought that those would come true too, but the demons aren't sovereign. They can't make it happen. God, however, can be sure that everything he predicts will happen because he is sovereign. He can make anything happen he wants to. Now, here the question of man's free will begins to be a fly in the ointment, because a lot of things that God predicts require that decisions be made by persons, that in some cases moral decisions, which we would say the person's free will is somehow involved in there. In fact, Cyrus's free will is somehow involved in the decision. He could have, for instance, chosen, we might say, if he had absolute free will, he might have chosen to do something other than be kind to the Jews. He might have persecuted them like other kings did, and that he made a decision not to do so, and God knew in advance what Cyrus would do and what he would decide. And so whether we say that God superimposed his own sovereign will upon that of Cyrus and took away Cyrus's free will in that instant, as some would say, or whether God simply saw in advance the choice Cyrus would make, is open to discussion. Actually, either argument would fit well and would not violate any scriptural principle with the case of Cyrus. But when we think of other cases, like Jesus predicting that Peter would deny him three times, or predicting that Judas would betray him, now there we get into more of a sticky situation. How did Jesus know that Judas would betray him? Did God make Judas betray him? How did he know that Peter would deny him three times? Did God make that happen sovereignly? It seems to go against our grain and against what we know of the character of God to suggest that God would force Peter to deny Jesus, which is a sinful thing to do, or to force Judas to betray Jesus. In other words, to consign the man to hell because he forced him to do something that was wicked. And that doesn't seem agreeable with the nature and character of God that we get from the Scriptures. So I, myself, am open to the view that some things that God foresees, he foresees not because he makes them happen, but because he has some other means unrevealed to us, that he knows the future without causing it necessarily. I don't believe he caused or forced Peter to deny Jesus three times, but I do believe he had accurate foreknowledge that Peter would do that. How he knew that without violating Peter's will, I don't know. And that's what I'm saying, that God doesn't tell us how he knows. Part of the answer seems to be he's sovereign enough to make things happen as he wants to. But there are some things that we would have a great difficulty saying that God made them happen, and yet they were predicted by him. So there may be some other means by which he knows the future besides that which is suggested here. We are not given all the information we would like. Verses 12 and 13 say, "Hearken unto me, you stout-hearted that are far from righteousness. I bring near my righteousness. It shall not be far off, and my salvation shall not tarry, and I will place salvation in Zion for Israel my glory." Now he speaks of persons who are far off from righteousness, meaning that by their actions they've removed themselves far from the way of living that God endorses, from the righteous way of living. And since they've removed themselves far off from his righteousness, he could say, well, if you're going to do that, I'll just ignore you and go the other way. But rather than that, he pursues. He says, I'll bring my righteousness to you then. I'll bring my righteousness near to you. Now this is essentially what in principle happened when God sent his only begotten Son into the world, because no one was reaching God, therefore God had to reach us. The real difference between Christianity and the religions of the world is that every religion, be it a little cult or a major world religion, has one thing in common. They have a set of rules by which they seek to please the divine being, or whoever they consider to be the ultimate power, whether it's a god or gods or a force. They nonetheless feel like there are certain things that we have to do in order to be in the good graces of that. With, the New Age movement, they don't believe in it's not necessarily a personal god. It might be just an impersonal force. But nonetheless, you still have to manipulate karma. You still have to do the right things to get the benefits you need. And to, the salvation comes from you doing the right things. And so with any religious system, any spiritual system, other than Christianity, salvation, whatever salvation means in a given religious system, it requires that you meet all these conditions. And if you don't, there's nothing that God will do for you. That the gods of the other religions do not make concessions. This God, the true God, however, if you remove yourself far from righteousness, he will bring his righteousness to you. And whereas other religions might be described as man's attempts to reach God, Christianity declares that God took the initiative of reaching down to us, because a man cannot reach God. The people who built the Tower of Babel wanted to reach up into heaven with this tower. But, I mean, the attempt is so ludicrous. Of course, they didn't know as much as we know about how big the universe is and everything like that. They might have thought maybe a few more stories will break through the covering here. But I mean, any other attempts to reach God by human efforts are no less ludicrous than the Tower of Babel. Whenever man by his own works attempts to attain to the holiness and righteousness of God, he's very grossly out of touch with reality, thinking that he has it within himself to do that. And therefore, Christianity says that what man could not do, God did. Man could not reach, could not span the distance between himself and God. Therefore, God spanned the distance by condescending. And though Jesus existed in the form of God, he took on himself the form of a servant. And what the law could not do, God took the initiative to do by sending his Son. So God says, I will bring my righteousness near, and it will be close, and my salvation shall not tarry. He's talking about sending his salvation and his righteousness. There can be little doubt that this is through the coming of Jesus Christ. He says, I will place salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory. Now, Zion, again, I've pointed out before that Zion is a reference frequently to Jerusalem, though in the Scriptures, sometimes Zion is used figuratively of the inhabitants of Jerusalem or of the people of God. This is very clearly seen, for instance, in Isaiah 51 and verse 16. Isaiah 51:16, at the end of that verse, it says, and say unto Zion, thou art my people. Say to Zion, you are my people. In other words, Zion refers to God's people in Isaiah 51:16. And so when he says, I will place salvation in Zion, we shouldn't understand that to be a geographical statement, that somehow the salvation of God will be centered in the mountain called Zion in the state of Jerusalem at some future time. But rather, to say I'll put salvation in Zion, he means in his people, among his people, he will minister and bring salvation wherever they happen to be. And for Israel, my glory. Israel, of course, remember, refers to the remnant, and the remnant eventually in time became the church, which is what we now belong to. So the salvation here described is a salvation that does not apply necessarily to national Israel or Jerusalem geographically, but rather to his people in general, the spiritual, the true Israel. And that is, of course, what we experience now. Chapter 47, as I said, is a continuation of a taunt against Babylon. He began to taunt against Babylon in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 46, but then he broke off to discuss again the futility of idols and to ridicule the fact that while God carries his people, the idols have to be carried by their people. And begins, of course, there he tells of his sovereignty and how he's calling Cyrus in to destroy Babylon. And now he sings a song to Babylon, a taunt song. As I said, it resembles an earlier chapter in the book of Isaiah. Actually, chapters 13 and 14 of Isaiah were against Babylon, and in 14, verses 4 through 21 particularly, there was a song taunting the king of Babylon, saying, oh, you who were so high, you who terrified the nations, now you are brought down low. And it is in that context that the Lucifer passage appears also. You know, the, how art thou fallen, O Lucifer? Referring apparently to the king of Babylon, how that he was self-exalted, and now he finds himself to be as low as any other man, just as much a mortal as those that he has destroyed previously. Here we have a similar message to Babylon. Basically, a different image is used. Babylon is compared to a woman. And that may be of interest to us when we consider the book of Revelation, because in Revelation chapter 17, there is also reference to a woman riding on a beast, and on her forehead is the name Mystery Babylon, the great, the mother of harlots, and of the abominations of the earth. So the woman in Revelation 17 is Mystery Babylon. That probably means spiritual Babylon as opposed to, Mesopotamian Babylon of history. Certainly we don't believe that Babylon that fell in the days of Cyrus is to be revived in the last days and to be represented by this woman in Revelation. Because in fact the Bible says that Babylon will never be rebuilt. So the Babylon, the woman of Revelation, is not the same historic Babylon that we have here, but both are represented as a woman. In the case of the woman in Revelation, Babylon the Great, the mystery Babylon, is represented as a harlot who's drunk with the blood of saints. In this case, the woman is not a harlot, but rather a virgin. And perhaps we don't know exactly why he speaks to Babylon as the virgin daughter of Babylon, but perhaps it means that as a virgin who has been able to keep herself from the molestation of aggressors and so forth, who has retained her purity, who has been safe and secure and remained pristine and unpolluted, you know, that is how Babylon has been in a sense. There's been no one who's been able to penetrate Babylon's defenses. They have been unpolluted by the invasion of other armies and so forth. They're still a virgin, as it were, because they are at their height in their glory and I don't really know how else to say it. It is a strange expression for us to see Babylon spoken of as a virgin. We know that Jerusalem also was called the virgin daughter, or the virgin of the daughter of Jerusalem. You remember that expression that came up back in chapter, I think it was 37. Let me get it here. And of course, Zion was certainly not a virgin in the spiritual sense at that time. It's Isaiah 37:22, where it says, "The virgin, the daughter of Zion, hath despised thee." The message that was sent to Rabshakeh. So realize that when it says the virgin, the daughter of Zion, it's talking about the city of Jerusalem. When it says the virgin daughter of Babylon, it's talking about the city of Babylon. It's a figure of speech. The city is compared to a woman. Just as in the book of Revelation, Mystery Babylon is compared to a woman. And in fact, in the book of Revelation, Jerusalem, New Jerusalem, is compared to a bride. So to compare a city with a woman is not unusual in the Bible. It's in the figurative language of the prophets. And here's how it goes. "Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground, there is no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans. For thou shalt no more be called tender and delicate, but you will no longer enjoy your pristine, unpolluted, unchallenged, immune status. You are going to be overthrown. Your throne is going to be overthrown. And that's why you've got to sit on the ground. You've got to sit in the dust because your throne is going to be removed. You won't be the ruling queen of the nations any longer. Take the millstones and grind meal. Uncover thy locks. Make bare the leg. Uncover the thigh. Pass over the rivers." Now, what all this refers to, I can't be sure. Taking millstones may suggest that she's going to have to be reduced to a working woman, like ordinary women who go out and grind their grain at the mill every morning. The queen ordinarily wouldn't do that, but her throne's now gone. She's reduced to the level of every other woman. She's no longer the queen. "Uncover thy locks, make bare the leg." I don't know exactly what that refers to. It may refer to uncovering the locks and making bare the leg may refer to girding up the skirts of the garment for the sake of working, again implying that she's going to have to work like everyone else. But not necessarily. "Thy nakedness shall be uncovered," which probably doesn't mean that she'll be made naked, but rather that she'll be seen for what she is. A lot of times nakedness in the scripture is not literal, but refers to exposure. That part of yourself that you would prefer to hide from public view is going to be exposed, and you'll be recognized for what you are. "Your nakedness shall be uncovered" may mean simply that you will be found to be vulnerable, which is something that you have always thought yourself not to be and always wanted to project yourself as being invulnerable. You'll be shown to be quite vulnerable after all. "Yea, thy shame shall be seen. I will take vengeance. I will not meet thee as a man." That is to say, when men and armies come against Babylon, ordinarily Babylon wins. But God won't come like a man comes. God's going to come like God comes. And when it's against God, they have no chance of victory over him. "As for our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Sit thou silent and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called the Lady of Kingdoms." Or the idea is that she's been like the queen of all the nations, but she's no longer going to have that status. "I was wroth with my people. I have polluted mine inheritance," God says, "and given them to thine hand. Thou didst show them no mercy. Upon the ancient hast thou very heavily laid thy yoke. And thou saidest, I shall be a lady forever, so that thou didst not lay these things to thy heart, neither didst remember the latter end of it. Now what he's saying is the reason that you had victory over Israel is because he says, I was angry with Israel and I polluted them. My inheritance refers to the land of Israel, God's inheritance, and his people, that he polluted them, he delivered them over, he gave them into Babylon's hand, and Babylon should have realized that, but instead they took the credit themselves and they just took advantage of the situation and showed no mercy and exploited the people and laid heavy yokes on the aged and so forth. And they thought that they had gained their power through their own intrinsic wisdom and power, and therefore they didn't remember or even consider that God was behind what was going on, and now they have to answer for their behavior before God. Therefore, hear now this, thou that art given to pleasures, that dwellest carelessly, that sayest in thine heart, I am, and there is none else beside me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. This is what she says of herself. But these two things shall come on thee in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood. Now, what this would mean, literally, would probably mean that she'd be a widow because her king would be killed. Belshazzar was killed when Cyrus marched in on that night. The loss of her husband or her king in the imagery here, and or perhaps even of her gods, because as Jehovah was the husband of Israel, so we might consider the imagery being that Bel and Nebo were the husband of Babylon. They were going to lose their king and their gods. They were going to lose their husband, in other words, whichever is intended. And their children, of course, would be their either the royal seed, the royal family, or else perhaps just their citizens in general. But she'll experience both. They shall come upon thee in their perfection. That is, widowhood and loss of children will come upon them in completion and perfection. For the multitude of thy sorceries and for the great abundance of thine enchantments. Which makes it very plain that it was not just worshiping idols that was involved in their religion, but it was actually sorcery. It was enchantments. It was occultism. It was involvement with demonic practices and worship of demons. For thou hast trusted in thy wickedness. Thou hast said, none seeth me. Thy wisdom and thy knowledge it hath perverted thee. And thou hast said in thine heart, I am, and there is none else beside me. Your wisdom and knowledge has perverted thee. This is something that unbelievers need to consider, that wisdom and knowledge is not always going to be to their benefit. We live in an age where college education and postgraduate degrees and so forth are always considered to be an advantage. But I've known many people whose faith in God have been destroyed by going off and getting more learning. And it's not because the more you learn of truth, the more unreal God seems, but rather simply because of the slanted view of truth that is being presented, or the outright lies that are presented through educational system. In the case of the Babylonians, they received a great deal of mystic knowledge through their sorceries and through their worship of their gods, but it happened to be false knowledge. And while they were ever learning, as Paul spoke of some, they were never coming to the knowledge of the truth. And the more they learned, the more off the track they got. It says they were perverted by their wisdom and their knowledge. As though the more they got, the more it hurt them, the more it perverted them. See, it is possible to be ever learning and never coming to the knowledge of the truth. There are people that I knew in Santa Cruz who seem to be career college students. It seemed like they were going to Cabrillo College, which was a junior college, forever. I mean, every year they'd go and take some more courses. They weren't working toward any goal. They just kind of enjoyed learning. They kind of enjoyed taking more in. They apparently got grants or something to live on. Maybe that was it. They preferred to go to college than work. But whatever the reason, I knew people who went for years and years to this two-year college just to take more and more courses. And I don't know what their motive was, but I would have to think with some of them at least, they relished knowledge. They wanted to gain more and more knowledge. And yet, they could go to that college for 40 years or 50 years and never come to the knowledge of the truth. And in fact, they might get further from the knowledge of the truth. Because if you're getting a perverted slant on the learning that you're getting, on the knowledge and wisdom that's being presented to you, then the more of it you get, the further from truth you get. And that was the case of the Babylonians. They through their sorceries, gained secret mystic knowledge and revelations, but they were demonic. And therefore, they led away from truth and actually contributed to their perversion. Realize, of course, even knowledge of true facts does not necessarily always benefit a person. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 8:1, knowledge puffeth up, but love edifies. And he's talking about knowledge of true things. In that particular context, in 1 Corinthians 8, he's actually talking about the realization that idols are nothing. The realization that we don't have to worship idols. That's truth. But some Corinthians were thinking themselves superior to others who didn't share that conviction. And Paul says, listen, don't let your knowledge puff you up. Having knowledge is not always beneficial spiritually. That is just the knowledge of true facts. Our head knowledge can really make you arrogant. And that's counterproductive. That's perversion to your spiritual life, to be arrogant about your imagined superior knowledge. What really makes a person superior is their love. And so, you know, the Apostle Paul was accused of being perverted by his knowledge. It was a false accusation, but it was, I think it was Felix who said to Paul, Paul, your much learning hath made you mad. Remember that statement? Implying that the guy had been in the books so long that something had snapped and he was, you know, just gone crazy. Well, Solomon tells us in Ecclesiastes that is a possibility. He says, of the making of many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. And I know that you can kind of drive yourself crazy trying to learn everything there is to know. But with the Babylonians, their problem was that their knowledge that they were gaining was not true knowledge. They were starting with false premises, namely that the idols that they worshipped were true beings that could be trusted. And when you start with a false premise, you might reason logically from one point to the next and never have a broken link in your chain of logic. But because your original premise was wrong, your conclusions are wrong. It's like if a person, you know, is sending a rocket up to, if NASA is sending a rocket up to the moon or something like that. If they've got the instruments pointed the rocket wrong, you know, just by an inch or so, you know, if the point of the thing is off by an inch or two, here, by the time it gets thousands and thousands of miles away, it's so far off course, may not even hit the moon. You know, if you're veered wrong at the beginning and you base everything else on that, then you're really far away by the time you've come to some of the more advanced conclusions down the line. And so false religion leads people further and further and further away from the truth. It isn't just that it's wrong on a few points and they could just easily correct over, but they have to change their basic premises, because the more reasoning and the more knowledge you get along the wrong lines, of course, the more perverted you'll be mentally. And that's why the Bible says we need to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. Because before we were Christians, though we may not have been involved in any other religions per se, yet our whole premises about life, about materialism, about looking out for number one, about whatever was our philosophy before we were Christians, it was all wrong. And we reasoned from the wrong premises from the beginning. And therefore, it's likely that almost all the things we think when we get saved could well be pretty far wrong. And so we need to go back and lay new foundations, get new premises based on the Word of God and reason properly from there. And to tell you the truth, it could take as long or longer